Why do all clouds look like dragons?
Listen, I live in a gym or a beach where I'm looking at the water. I don't really pay much attention to the clouds. I couldn't tell you a single thing, but I think it's like a psychological Rorschach thing. Mm-hmm. I don't see dragons when I see them. I used to see George Washington a lot.
Wig, you see this wig?
Yeah,
in the back.
I think so. Yeah, and bears. I remember when I was a kid, always seeing bears up there. But I think, have you been watching Game of Thrones again, Tom?
No, I just, when I was out there, I saw a lot of dragons. I think once you see one dragon, they all look like dragons. It's just all confirmation bias. Like when my wife was pregnant, she was like, everyone I know is pregnant now. I'm like, no, it's only because you are pregnant. Now you see, you notice all of the pregnant people out there.
You're describing the curriculum of my basketball world. There's something we call the reticular activation center, which filters out everything but those that are threat or value stimuli to us. Otherwise, we get paralyzed the way a computer used to freeze up and it had too many functions open. And so, for example, I always tell players, when you're driving the same route every day to practice, and I'll say, and they'll say, yeah, I take the same route. I say, okay, tell me the billboards you pass. And they couldn't tell me a single billboard. I said, okay, but if you're in the market for a Lexus, and there's a billboard for a Lexus, you will recognize that because it's valuable to you. Just like you think the light turned green 20 seconds ago, but really your brain was looking at it the whole time. It turned green and then you click back on. That's what it does. So my teaching is all about getting guys to recognize things of threat and value that he wouldn't normally recognize. So how do we read defenses? How do we read our teammates? These things are going all the time. You never saw it before. That's why we say college kids play the game and pros read the game. There's a huge difference in how they're taking all that stimuli and processing it and reacting to it, which college kids don't even see these things. So that's why, for some reason, you either are scared of or really value dragons.
Coach, how do you do that? How do you teach a player to start to read these things as stimuli as opposed to just billboards that we don't care about?
Yeah, so, well, just I just did it today. We had a 7:30 workout this morning with some guys. And so if you watch the finals, I know really closely, guys, every single possession when the Bucks were switching, Chris Paul was snake dribbling off the ball screen every single time, right? He was dragging out that switch and then forcing, in many cases, it was Lopez. Do you want to come out at me? I'm still 16, 15 feet away from the basket on the opposite elbow, or are you going to stay home? And Chris Paul was letting the play develop around him because he values all those time and space concepts. The college kid or the young pro just uses green and gets to where he wants to go and looks to shoot, whatever. But there's no rhythm, timing, context to it. Chris Paul has learned to appreciate all that space and time construct that's going on. It's one of many, many examples. Another would be Kevin Durant has learned. Kevin Durant learned this, I think, for Oklahoma City. Watch him in the Olympics. All he ever does is put his great big long arm in the air early. Early high hand contested shots, and you could look at Second Spectrum, more recent data, I haven't done in a couple of years, but it automatically dictates a lower percentage. So Kevin Durant is always processing, I'm not really sure what's going to happen. Let me just get my paw up there. I'll stay low in case he drives. I'm just leaving it up there all the time. He's not trying to block the shot. If you throw into his hand, he gets a block shot. He's just trying to make you think about it. That's a learned process thing where he appreciates it can have an impact. If he has no chance to block the shot, whereas most other guys are doing way too late and the ball's already gone. I don't think Mark Jackson says a lot of super smart things, but he says hand down, man down. Like there's a reason for that. It's true that you get that hand up too late. It's too late. They've already got the clear look out of the guy. You got to get it up early. Early high hand contest is what we call it.
Welcome to the Haber Show. I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Welcome to the Haber Show. I'm Tom Haberstroh. That's Amin Al Hassan. So, Coach, you talk about the college players play the game and then the pro players read the game. One of the debates I've had in my head is whether Cade Cunningham, what kind of prospect he is at the next level. And a lot of early comps to Luka Doncic. And I just watched Luka Doncic this morning playing with how many NBA players are on that Slovenia team, Coach?
Yeah, I mean, I understand your point. Certainly not like Team USA, which is nothing but NBA players. Tom, if you're going to try to argue that Cade Cunningham, while very talented and certainly has a chance to be an all-star, whatever, but isn't in the same league as Luka, I'm on your side. Because Luka is like LeBron James. We'll never see the likes of him again.
Right, because when I'm watching Luka and he gets like, I think something like 18 assists with this Slovenia team, and he has a triple-double, and the argument for Cade Cunningham only averaging 3.5 assists at Oklahoma State is look at the teammates. Like, he has no supporting cast. Like, you try getting 10 assists on that roster. And my point is, man, if you're comparing this dude to Luka, and I don't think it's a fair comparison, but I heard it ad nauseum during the draft process, like, they're just not even in the same stratosphere in terms of creators and distributors. And so I think it's just the flavor of the month that people look at Cade Cunningham. He's a big point guard. Oh, Luka Doncic, big point guard. And I just think it's I don't know what I didn't see what you wrote about Cade Cunningham or your impressions of him, but I would say he does not remind me of Luka Doncic. He reminds me more of a Tracy McGrady in his best. He's just a slithery, tall, big ball handler who can shoot the heck out of the ball.
No. Tracy McGrady's from here. The only thing those two guys have in common, they both have ears, okay? I understand your point about size.
Yeah.
I understand your point about size, and I think you're right that people are the flavor of the month thing, but I think the real reason why, Tom, they're comparing the two is because Luka dominates the game without being a very good athlete, at least by the standards we use. Running jump and hot, fast and super quick and all that. Okay. And Cade Cunningham, while definitely a good athlete at 6'8", isn't, he's not at that elite level. And so those that wanted to make the argument, well, Cade has to go number one, which I did not make. I thought I had him third rated on our board. It's not like it's a bad place. I had him behind Mobley and Barnes personally, in terms of where I think they can get if all good things happen for them. If you want to argue that he's going to be worthy of number one pick, well, then you got to make the argument he's like Luka. I think he's more of Lonzo Ball, Jason Tatum. Like, I think he can get to be a primary ball handling type like Lonzo. I think he wants to score more than Lonzo ever did until more recently. Although, how do you really know when Lonzo played off the ball? But he's got Jason Tatum's side. Tatum isn't an amazing athlete. He's more explosive than Cade. But I think Cade at this age is much better off the dribble. Any Celtics fans will tell you how hard it was to watch Tatum his rookie season as a primary ball handler. But you wouldn't say that now. So I don't think he probably gets the Tatum's level. I do think he has a chance to be better than Lonzo, who I think is very good and has just been misutilized for much of his career.
See, the comp that I was making when I was watching, obviously I wasn't deep diving into college basketball while it was happening. It was kind of just playing catch up during draft time. But
me too.
He reminded me of Sean Livingston, like a better scoring Sean Livingston in terms of the same level athleticism. Like, Sean wasn't a bad athlete. He was a good athlete. He wasn't jump out the gym, but he was a good athlete. He had great size and then great passing instinct. And then, I think Cade just is better at the same age at scoring the ball than Sean was. And this is obviously pre-knee explosion.
Listen, I mean, I don't remember anymore. Was Sean Livingston not an elite athlete prior to the knee injury? I don't remember.
He was good. He wasn't Russell Westbrook. He was like, he was a good, kind of like Cade. He's like a good athlete.
He's a good athlete, yeah. Yep. And he guards. I made the comparison to Lonzo only in the sense that they have similar size dimension types. But Cade's really willing to throw hit-ahead passes. I was impressed with that. I don't think he's a very gifted passer. I think Barnes is a much more gifted passer. And I actually greatly value those kinds of players that can lead players to bucket they wouldn't normally get. I don't know that Cade is that guy. But he's willing to move it up the floor, which I think will help him. I don't know that he has to be a point guard to be effective. I'm not sure ultimately that'll be his best position. He's certainly willing to defend. I thought Barnes was the most charismatic character. Again, Mobley is my highest rated player. Cunningham really impressed me, guys, on draft night. Having not seen a single interview with him all year, and it's just an interview. So I recognize that doesn't necessarily mean everything. I found him to be incredibly interesting and thoughtful. He's a thoughtful young man. You need to be thoughtful in this game.
He's like that. I know we had him on NBA radio.
I listened to it. I heard it.
He is that guy in terms of, giving you answers that are, it's funny you said it's just an interview, but you just reminded me of Giannis in the finals being asked about the block he had on Aiton.
Yeah.
And his ability to clearly not just articulate, but break it down step by step. He says, I'm up, I'm playing the pick and roll. What's his name? Paul's coming off. And he says, I felt Ayton roll. I didn't see him roll. I felt him roll. So he says, I take one step and then I go back and now I'm jumping and I know I'm too late because I took the wrong step. So because I'm too late, I can't go and try to contest the dunk at the spot. I've got to shortcut it and go to the front of the rim. And just the way he's talking about all of this and all the things he's realizing in real time, that guy went, I'm too late. I went the wrong way. I need to get there. I can't get there. I've got to go here. I want to believe that there's something to that. Someone being able to process that information to a level where they can literally just sit down and walk you step by step through it. It's no different than LeBron saying, hey, I remember that J.R. Smith bucket that he had at the 434 mark of the third quarter when we played him in the playoffs in game 3. And it was at the Garden. It was at that basket over there. And he went up and under. Like, I think there's something to that in terms of greatness, of being able to not only recall, but also like break it down to individual building blocks.
If you guys watch any major golf tournaments, after every round the player goes into the clubhouse and the first thing the player does, almost always the first thing, is they go through all 18 holes and they go, you know, driver, 5-iron, wedge, second hole, then say second hole, they just go through it. They're not looking at the scorecard. They know it. Well, maybe sometimes they're on the scorecard, but all they see is the par. They know what they use every single time. And so your point on LeBron and the Giannis interview, Giannis, you were talking about, luckily the pass was just a little bit behind him or I wouldn't be able to make the play. Like that was a humble admission by him that I really appreciated. But like all these guys could do that. I mean, if I go out to have it nowadays, so my players are retired and, you know, they're 30s. And if we meet for a cocktail at, you know, 11 o'clock somewhere on the beach, I remember that game in Indiana where I faked for the hand up, went back door and got an easy dunk, you know, in the third quarter of the February game on Jermaine O'Neal. But yeah, I remember those things too, but not always. They always do. And that's years later. If you talk about them the day after the game, they remember every play. They know the name of the play call. I don't think it's every player, but this goes back to being thoughtful, being mindful of this craft. All the serious players know all that stuff. Yeah, they may not be as genius as Rondo and LeBron, who I do think those guys are geniuses, but they're genius enough to be able to follow. Otherwise, they get lost. And it's not hard to recognize the guys that get lost, right? And I also think, just to finish the thought and connect to Team USA, if you're watching these games, we're seeing Zach LaVine elevate himself, at least on the ball and off the ball defensively in a way that I don't remember seeing during the season. Now, it's easy when you don't have to score 25 points a game. Right, there's a lot more energy when you don't have to do everything and you got KD on your team. And Tatum and Holiday are playing amazing too. But I've always thought Zach processed the game slowly. Zach was very good at the me aspect of the game. I never thought he was great at the – I don't think he is great at the we aspect of the game, but I think it's coming. And so for Bulls fans, we can argue the DeRozan acquisition. That's a good sign. I think having Lonzo, which will allow him to think more me, which is what Zach's best at anyway, which is good. Zach is a really good me player. If he can also develop the we thing, they have to have that for them to be real contenders. Zach's got to be a we player and a me player, not just a me player.
Yeah, they're hoping in Chicago that DeMar DeRozan is going to continue the we part of his game that he's advanced and developed in San Antonio under Greg Popovich. Now that he's going to Chicago and he's going to be in the backcourt with Zach LaVine, with Kobe White, with Alex Caruso, that's a lot of ball handlers there. I mean, not that Caruso is going to be, you know, dominating the ball, but let's talk about free agency here, Coach.
Okay.
The Lakers redid their roster. 64% of their roster is going to be new. Only 36% of their roster is returning around Anthony Davis and LeBron James. They are going to have Kendrick Nunn, Kent Bazemore, Trevor Ariza, Malik Monk, Wayne Ellington, Carmelo Anthony, and Dwight Howard. How do you feel about that supporting cast?
Way better the last 24 hours than I did the first 24 in free agency, when they were collecting a very, very old team.
Russell Westbrook, too. That guy.
And Russ, yeah, I know. I thought that Henry Abbott wrote a great piece the other day where he just really went into how rare it is for guys 33 and over to be elite players. And so if you take away the equation of what's the probability Davis is healthy all year, or at least enough of the year, LeBron and Russ, take that away. I I think the Lakers have, they got to be thrilled with some of those young guys that they got. Malik came around this year. That'll be helpful. They have an interesting mix, guys, of players last year who were very good on offense, but bad on defense. Very good on defense, but bad on offense. Into a culture and system for 2 years in a row where they've been, they were, think they were third in defense 2 years ago, number one last year. Vogel clearly has got them really locked in defensively. Davis and LeBron have talked about it over these last couple of years. So I think they feel like our culture will build up our good offensive players that struggled to guard last year. And then our offense needs the infusion of these talented offensive players who can't really guard in previous years anyway. And I had them off my contender list after the Russ acquisition. They're back on now. How healthy they can be is something that I'm just not going to try to guess in early August. It doesn't look super promising, but it's not like Davis is 42. You know, he's 28. It's a concern, but I like, they have enough young guys with LeBron and Davis, and then we can talk about the Russ thing, you know, separately.
Are you surprised that guys like Malik Monk and Kendrick Nunn got out of their restricted free agencies as easily as they did and got to sign for deep discounts?
Surprise is a great word. Yeah, I guess I'm a little bit surprised. I mean, let me ask you guys this. You follow the game as closely as I do. Don't you think what Reggie Jackson did, which we don't know yet, I don't think he's got a contract yet.
No, he doesn't.
Right, he hasn't signed yet, has he?
As of this taping, no. On Thursday morning, he still hasn't.
So don't you think that some guys are thinking, well, I'm going to pull a Reggie Jackson? As if that's not a sound strategy. I don't want to be sarcastic. That isn't the soundest of strategies to pull a Reggie Jackson. Nonetheless, if players all think that they're Reggie Jackson, they think they can score if they get the chance. And I think the Lakers are likely to make the finals. I'm not saying that at all. I don't think they are likely. I think it's possible. So I think they want to roll the dice on themselves that way.
For me, I say Reggie Jackson pulled a Reggie Jackson because he had $35 million in the bank.
I agree.
Like, he's set. Kendrick Nunn has been on a rookie deal for 2 years, right? And Malik Monk was on a modest rookie scale deal that was lottery, but not like a top five pick money. So, I mean, I guess we should be applauding them to say, hey, I know I have a limited window for livelihood for my entire lifetime and the lifetime of my children and, you know, what other family members around me. But I'm going to take this leap of faith to think that being part of something special might bring further riches down the line, or maybe just the fulfillment of saying I was on a championship team. But I was staggered. I said, guys like that, you know, you go make your money, and then when it doesn't work out 5-6 years down the line, you can start thinking about, you know, the discount bargain bin.
I can honestly say I've never had a player tell me he would place a title over the money until very, very late in their career.
Until they've made the money.
And even then, I heard you, I mean, today, talking about your friends in New Orleans and the whole Chris Paul situation, because you're not wrong. We can argue whether or not he's worth that money separately. But your point was, if that's your target, well, then blow it out of the water so they can't match. I heard your argument. It was great, you and Zach. And the point is, to our discussion here, you might have been right. So Chris Paul, knowing he's not going to championship in New Orleans as currently constructed, although Zion's fun to play with, I don't think we think they're going to win the championship. But all of that bread, right, all of that money still appeals to human beings that have a lot of it in the bank. And I understand it. It's okay to be motivated that way. Why should they not be motivated? Everyone else is. So I don't disagree. I think that to chase their title or a chance at a title, if that's your ultimate goal, I think it's a mistake at those young guys' careers. But if you're thinking Reggie got himself a lot more money because he played so well in the playoffs, now again, that happened because Kawhi was hurt. Kawhi doesn't go down. Reggie Jackson isn't doing those things, I wouldn't think, and probably isn't worth whatever he's going to end up signing for. So it's a very risky move, and you're hoping LeBron and Davis are healthy come springtime.
For the people wondering, we're reacting off of Brian Windhorst on the Hoop Collective podcast, basically said that New Orleans, we'd heard rumors of New Orleans making a strong pitch for a max-type player, and that's why they were clearing all that space, and it turns out it was Chris Paul, and they made a $100 million offer. And I guess that's why the Suns came with a fourth year with that partial guarantee to Chris Paul to kind of take their offer over the top. But the reality is, yeah, I was like, look, if you're going to go after Chris Paul, you've got to make it a number that makes Phoenix uncomfortable, right? And like Coach said, forget about whether he's going to be worth it in 3 or 4 years, or whatever. You're looking at a guy who can move your program forward significantly, particularly with, you know, two building blocks of Zion and Brandon Ingram, which is a lot. I mean, at this stage, at the same stage, it's a lot better than what Phoenix was working with.
It's better than most teams you're dealing with.
Because Phoenix had Devin Booker in the same situation a year ago. We like Devin Booker. Everyone had question marks about DeAndre Ayton.
Right.
And Chris Paul did an amazing job as far as helping him. And obviously, part of that is DeAndre Ayton had a child, and that helps really speed up your maturity a little bit and puts things in perspective, take things seriously. But like, there's a world where Chris Paul doesn't get traded to the Suns, and DeAndre Ayton is a guy that we like, but is never really one that we think of as can be relied upon.
I want to know what you guys think about all of these deals. When we're talking about Kendrick Nunn and Malik Monk taking these basically bargain deals to go play with LeBron and chase a championship, or at least develop kind of like what you said about DeAndre Ayton with next to Chris Paul and reach heights that they might not have done so in a, you know, a bottom dwelling team, but get your money. I mean, you look at the most bargain contracts so far in the NBA, and I did this. I compared the ProfitX contracts projection and John Hollinger's projection and try to figure out what are the best deals, the best bargain deals, team-friendly deals. And they're all on the contenders. All of them. I mean, look at Bobby Portis taking $4.5 million a year over a 2-year deal to go back to Milwaukee. Look at Andre Drummond. And we can talk about Andre Drummond and what he makes sense for a contender as a starter, but as a backup? As a backup, a vet minimum deal, and then you look at Blake Griffin, Bruce Brown, Jeff Green. These guys, I feel like they could have gotten more money elsewhere, but they're wanting to be in that situation where they can chase a championship. And man, that whole idea about betting on yourself, that's a risky gamble for some of these youngsters. Andre Drummond is at a point in his career where he has to rehabilitate his value around the league. Maybe he does that in Philly, but that was a surprising deal for me. What say you, Coach? Andre Drummond and his fit next to, or I guess I should say behind Joel Embiid.
Well, from Philly's perspective, it's glorious. He's good. He's a good player. I don't think any of us think he's great. He's a good, solid player. Embiid cannot be counted on for 82 games, and you should not be playing him 32 minutes a game. You should be down to probably 28 to 30, and you can pick and choose because they're going to smash some teams. They're loaded. So when they're smashing a bad team, play Embiid less, who cares about his stats, although Embiid might because he wants to win MVP. And when I guess the better teams play him a little bit more, so he can wash out the 28 minutes. So Embiid gets all of those minutes and those starts when Embiid's out. I mean, Drummond gets those minutes. Great. That's good for Philly. It was surprising to me that Drummond couldn't merit a starting spot anywhere. That seemed weird to me. But again, good for Philly. I think that they're we remember just a couple years ago, they destroyed the Raptors when Embiid was on the court and got smashed when he was off. There's no way Daryl Morey forgot that. What does he ever forget? So he wasn't there anyway, but he still remembers it. So there was no way that they were going to season not having some protection when Embiid wasn't in the game. The bigger question is, how fast are they trading Simmons?
Are you surprised, Coach, at how quick the tide has changed on Simmons? I mean, I get it. The way they went out in the playoffs wasn't ideal. It's a pretty embarrassing moment. But I'm a little staggered by the rapidity that they're ready to just quit on this. Based on a guy who is 25 years old, perennial all defense, perhaps the most versatile, best defensive player that we have in this league, one of the best passers, his assist led to more threes than any other player in the league. I mean, there's a lot to love, a lot to love about Ben Simmons. And yes, there are a couple of things that are irritating, flaws that need to get better, but I'm staggered at how quickly this is like, it's not going to work. Get rid of him.
Listen, I will admit that I am one of the least knowledgeable men or women covering the NBA off the court. I don't really pay attention, guys. I'm just an old man now. I just try to see what's happening between the lines. Typically, I do try to keep, I listen to you guys all the time. I try to stay caught up, but it's too much for my tiny little brain. Beyond the fact that I'm focused on the course so much, year round pretty much. But I think I heard just today, and it might have been on your show, I mean, because I listened to a few shows. I was working guys out of seven this morning. Someone was talking about how the Simmons camp is the one saying, we're not going back. Now, they might be saying this overtly.
Reportedly, I should say. There's only one reporter I saw that said it, and he's not one of the traditional newsbreakers around these types of things. But he said that the Simmons camp is, Simmons himself is not communicating with the team anymore and has been instructed, the Sixers have been instructed to do everything through Rich Paul. That's the report.
So there you go. So who really quit on whom? Because I think they know Daryl. There's an interesting contradiction in free agency where, without question, Simmons was a part of deals, trade deals. But also, I can guarantee you, without question, Doc Rivers was trying to convince free agents to come because they have Ben Simmons on their team. Now, and so when I would speak to some of those players or the representatives about, what do you think? And I would say, well, Doc is just trying to get you to sign, man. Like, I don't think he really thinks Ben's going to be there, or maybe he doesn't want to know the other stuff. I know coaches, they have a relationship with their players. They just try to leave it at that. They don't try to do the other stuff. Doc already tried some of that as GM too. So I'm just going to coach my guys up. As far as I know, Ben's on my team. What you said to me is exactly right. He's a tremendous player with some huge flaws and some mental issues to go with that. He wouldn't be the first guy that overcame some mental incapacities as it relates to on-court play. LeBron James melted down against the Mavericks. I was there. I had dinner before me. Henry Abbott and I had dinner with Roland Beach. Remember Roland?
Who was
he was working for the Mavs. We had dinner at that cool sushi place in the Epic Hotel. He was, and he was very confident they were going to win. And after dinner, I said to Henry, like, I think Roland's a super smart guy, but he's fucking whacked out of his mind. How is he so confident? Well, I guess he felt like they were going to do something to get LeBron's head. Well, meanwhile, LeBron became maybe the best of all time, right? He wasn't at that point. So Ben Simmons could outgrow this. I think you're right. I mean, I made a living off this, helping guys get past certain issues that they have. But it seems like the team Simmons feels like, we're not going to get healthy, whatever that means, however you want to take it, here in Philadelphia, where they're happy to snowball Santa Claus, right? We're going to go somewhere else.
My issue here is that Daryl Morey has to recognize that he's trading Ben Simmons when his trade value is lowest as it's been, maybe what, in the last 2-3 years? I mean, I'm trying to imagine a place when Ben Simmons' stock has been lower than it is right now. And this is business 101. So you buy low and sell high. And so for him, this has got to be tough, is that he has to build up his trade value enough to get past the hole he didn't shoot in the fourth quarter, past the hole he's passing up a wide open dunk because he's afraid to get to the free throw line. He has to get past there. He can't. There's nothing Daryl Morey can do right now to bump up his trade value enough to get a quote-unquote fair return on Ben Simmons, because everyone in the league is operating under the belief of, did you just see him crater in the playoffs just now? I'm not going to give you that, you know, 4 draft picks and 3 pick swaps. And everyone's seeing that this game of chicken is not working out in Daryl Morey's favor so far. I mean, tomorrow he could sign a deal that's going to be ridiculous for Ben Simmons, but his trade value is so low right now. It is, it's got to be killing Daryl Morey. Like, he just gets this job a year later, and now he has this superstar who, you know, in a year's time, if he gets change of scenery, that's the real problem, is if he goes to a new situation, whether it's Portland or whether it's Golden State, and he just says, you know what, grass is greener on the other side, I'm going to tackle these mental issues or these things, these obstacles that are these yips, and actually deal with this because I'm in a new situation. And that's got to be just in the back of Daryl Morey's head, is that I can't just take any deal. But then again, are you really going to play Ben Simmons next to Andre Drummond, Joel Embiid? Like, that can't work.
I spoke to a team president on draft day, Tom, who drafted the morning of the draft, and he was reading me some, I mean, I'm not going to say any names, but I'm just telling you, he was reading me off what Daryl was asking for. And I'll just say this. In addition to, and it's possible this guy was joking, but he said, he named all these names that he wanted from his team. And then he said, and he wants Shaquille O'Neal too. So his point was like, he wants things I do not have and would never give up. But that's, you guys know, that's how Daryl operates. That's smart, right? In negotiation, he's not going to give you an inch. But he, you know, I think in his mind, he would love for Ben Simmons and the team camp there to say, "Hey, we'll go back to Philly. That'd be fine." So that he can let this play out. Maybe Ben has, I mean, imagine if Ben's November player of the month, which is certainly possible. He is a very, very talented player, right? On both ends. And then trade value goes up and maybe makes the free throws in a couple of games, you trade him the next day. That's the best play for Daryl. But if Simmons won't even come, it's an issue.
Man, it's tough. It's tough. And this is the tough part about this is that we really don't know who's responsible for saying what, right? The conversation, whether it's coming from the team, whether it's coming from the agent. I think about, like, for instance, the reported deal that was offered to Golden State that Golden State turned down, which was Wiggins, Wiseman, the two firsts from 2021, and two future firsts for Simmons. And it's the two future firsts were the part where the Warriors said, we're out on that. And I just thought to myself, wait, who leaked that?
I was just thinking that when you said that. I was just thinking that.
Right?
It's Golden State.
I mean, but what's the messaging there if you're Golden State? What's the leverage you're pulling? You just
want people to dunk on Daryl Morey publicly or have people dunk on Daryl Morey for asking for too much and drive that price down to something more reasonable.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I get that.
Because that's the MO for Daryl Morey, right? Like, Coach, you said it. Is like, this is how Daryl Morey operates. Sure. Is he's going to ask for the world and then finally, kicking and screaming, fine, I'll settle for, you know, two first rounders instead of four, right? And he's not the first person to do this, but a lot of GMs seem to be leaking this, right? A lot of GMs seem to be leaking what he's asking for or willing to talk about it with people who have front-facing positions. So I think... I think that's coming from Golden State somewhere, leaking, you know, whether it's a game of telephone from an executive to an agent to a reporter or what have you. But I think that is it's kind of like the Danny Ainge thing, right? It's like it's become kind of a punchline so far. So when Danny Ainge is like, yeah, we were in on LeBron James, we were in on X player, and we really liked this player before he went somewhere else. Like, I feel like other GMs are looking at these trade proposals from Daryl Morey and saying, if we leak this publicly, Daryl is going to have no choice but to lower his price tag, his asking number, because no one wants to be that. No one wants to be known as that guy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just... It's kind of messed up. It really puts the Sixers at a huge disadvantage because, you know, before they could get away with quietly shopping the guy. Now you know, they try to get me up out of here. Even if that's what you want, as Coach said, maybe it is Simmons that's driving, they want to get out of there. But I just don't see too many scenarios where you can walk in the training camp in about a month and a half and be like, everything's cool though, right? Like, we just, you know, show up to work and pretend nothing happened.
Right. Did you see the way Embiid greeted Drummond yesterday?
Yeah.
That was a little bit shifty.
There's
some culture battles that are going on there. Yeah. There's going to be some issues. And, God, did you see who the Sixers just hired?
Yes, Phil Beckner. Phil the Drill.
Who's his top client?
Oh, I believe it's some kid from Weber State. So, yeah,
Damian Lillard.
Probably not that good of a player.
Yeah, but that isn't by accident, guys. That to me, I'm just telling you what I see. You're welcome to argue with me, of course, but I think it's Daryl saying, hey, Damian, tell your GM it's time. I'm out of here. Let's go. Just hire your guy. Colleges do it all the time. Now, I realize Damian is no college kid. He's a grown-ass man with a whole bunch of money in the bank and a ton of leverage and power. But they just hired your guy that you are going to want to go see that you can't turn the season out because he's employed by another team. It happens to be that a team that has a player who is an all-star, who is a former all-league player that's only 25, who is a defensive specialist on a team that is bad on defense that we've all been rumoring about anyway, right, talking about. I think it's Daryl saying, okay, I'm empowering you, Mr. Lillard. Go tell your GM you're ready to pull the deal. Why else do you hire that guy?
There's breaking news, guys. Messi is leaving Barcelona.
Didn't he just sign like the crazy deal not 2 months ago or a month ago?
It doesn't matter over there. The team we bought into a couple years ago that was in the Premier League got relegated because after a great season, our two best players held out. And of course, many of us NBA guys that bought into the team said, screw it, just play without him, but you can't do it. Agents control everything. And if you don't acquiesce to a player's wishes, the agents, of which there's just a few that control all the players, will never send another player to you again. And you'll just keep getting relegated. So players have all the power with their agents. Messi does whatever he wants to do.
Especially these players of that caliber, right?
Yeah, that's a whole other level, right?
Thorpe, I got to ask you this.
So where'd he go, Tom?
I don't know where he's going. I don't know anything about soccer, so not the slightest clue. But I wanted to ask you this. I apparently didn't have the slightest clue about what Steph Curry was going to do this summer because I wrote this essay for Lebatard Show about how Stephen Curry, I asked a bunch of GMs whether they thought Stephen Curry is going to return, sign that $215 million max extension for over 4 years, which would make him the first player ever to have back-to-back $200 million plus deals. And I kind of felt like the direction that the Golden State Warriors were heading, plus the kind of whispers I was hearing in the marketplace, is that Stephen Curry might just make them wait, might hold this extension over their head and try to get them to make some deals to make them win now or have a championship contender. And within 2 days of that happening, Stephen Curry signs for the 4-year max extension and makes me look like a complete idiot, right?
Typical.
Coach, Amin El-Hassan said after the Phoenix Suns went up 2-0 in the finals that Milwaukee Bucks wouldn't win, have zero chance of winning another game for the rest of the series. And of course, the Bucks win the title. My question to you, Coach, what is the loudest wrong thing you've ever said in your job as an analyst? The loudest wrong you've been on a player or a team? Because I was just loud wrong about the Stephen Curry extension. He just made me look like an idiot. Taking my lumps. Amin took his dunks right in Milwaukee. Coach, what is the thing that people still hit you up about on Twitter or social media or your buddies in the industry and be like, hey, remember that call you made about this player or that team? What's the most loud wrong you've been?
I mean, I've been doing this since 07, so I'm sure there's dozens of things I've gotten wrong.
Wait, since you were 7?
No, since 2007.
2007. Wow. Your connection is terrible, Tom.
Okay. That's Smoky Mountains there.
Yeah, right. By the way, can we put in better internet in the mountains in this new infrastructure bill we're trying to get passed? Like, a whole lot of people live in the mountains. Can we give them good Wi-Fi too?
It's funny, Coach. I didn't know that satellite HughesNet Wi-Fi even was a real thing until Tom the other day. I thought it was just a commercial that they ran for people in Iowa or in Idaho. No, it turns out, no, man.
Right.
It's real.
No one really reminds me much of anything, which is probably pleasant. About a year ago, I wrote a piece saying I wouldn't take LaMelo Ball in the first round.
That's a good one.
Now, I also wrote he's a potential multi-time all-star. That's a better offensive version of Ben Simmons. I mean, that was in there. But, of course, people aren't paying attention to the details. My point was, given the fact that he was cleaning his sneakers on defense during games and the whole thing with his dad, I am a big believer in culture. A big, big believer in the Ted Lasso version of sports, right? And I don't think that situation where he, I thought, was playing for the brand and his father always had the potential of knocking my GM and my coach. In fact, what I said on our show is I would have a meeting with them and tell them the first time the dad calls for anything regarding our coach or our management, if I was the owner, I'm trading LaMelo the next day. We'll never think about it again. It'll be our bad. We're not going to do the same as we want, but I'm not putting up with a team that it's already hard enough to win in this league. Look at how hard Milwaukee had to go with one of the best players in the world. It took them 3 tries after 2 MVPs to finally get there, right? To have a breakdown because of a famous parent who's always on sports radio and sports talk on TV, and a player that I don't know, he never showed to me in Australia, he cared about winning. I saw the talent. That's pretty obvious, again, as I wrote that. But I'm all about wanting to crush the other team and get paid because I'm crushing the other team. And I'm never going to have anyone in my camp publicly talk about my coach or my management. So that's why I wrote, again, 2 months before the draft or whatever. and I didn't have a meeting with them. It was just me standing aside. That was probably the loudest, more recent thing I've said anyway.
Coach, I'm a little surprised that you would have had that stance, not because of what you saw of him as a player, but like annoying parents are a tale as old as time, right? Like,
but they're never on TV. I agree with you. I mean, of course you should never worry about parents, but this guy's always on TV. And there's a reason why I think Lonzo was part of that deal initially. And I wonder why he's not in New Orleans now. I've not asked David that question, nor anyone on that staff. Why did you feel like you couldn't bring Lonzo? You asked it today, Amin, on your show this morning. Like, now, if they don't get along, I'm not aware of it. So it's fair to say I'm not aware of that. But how can you not like to play with Lonzo Ball?
Right.
He's a pass-first defender that's become a very good, reliable shooter, and he's a super humble guy. Like, I don't have a problem with that. So it's easy to have Lonzo. LaMelo and his dad, was I running a team, I would have had to get very comfortable with what's going to happen. And his dad did, by the way, claim that LaMelo's pissed he's coming off the bench. And very quickly after that, he started. Now, it worked out much better once he started. I don't like playing that game. I just don't like playing it. I think it's hard enough to win with all the egos and all the money and all the agents and everyone in these kids' ear and social media, where I have to deal with a famous dad talking shit about my coach or my management. I wouldn't play that very easily. So people can criticize me all they want. Again, all of us live in a world. I don't think if you asked Amin to spend to bet $1,000, I don't know what the number is, Amin. I know what you predicted. I listened. I actually thought the Bucks had a real good chance to win. In fact, I said on our show, Tom, you may know, I thought it was a Bucks-Raptors series in reverse. I thought the better team lost game two. Phoenix just shot out of their minds. But you would not have bet $1,000 the Bucks would have won a single game.
No.
What would you have bet? $30? $80? It wasn't a lot of money.
I probably would have put about $200 on it. And I'm going to tell you why. For me, it came down to several factors. Number one, Milwaukee, historically, not talking about in that series, historically, very averse to adjustment, right? Number two, their best player is coming back from his knee looking like an elbow. Like, people are just forgetting that part. Yeah. That this, like 10 days earlier, he had a flamingo's leg. And so no matter how surprised I was, oh, he looks better than I thought in those first two games, there was no part of me that could fathom that within the next two games, he would look like he never got hurt to begin with, which is what, by game four, he looked normal. People say, oh, game four, he came down because he had the back-to-back 40s in two and three. Game four, to me, was his best game until game six. So, like, those were the two big things. And then the third thing was, like, the Suns had been consistent. They were the most consistent team in these playoffs. After game three against the Lakers, all the way through the first two games of the finals, this team played great on at home, great on the road. The role players knew their roles. Everyone was doing their thing. Chris Paul was managing everything. Devin Booker would, you know, some nights he'd be efficient, sometimes he wouldn't, but he was always there. And so to me, there was no part of this that was saying, oh yeah, the Bucks are going to make changes and Giannis is going to feel much better. And all of a sudden, these role players who weren't afraid to play in LA at Staples against the mighty Lakers, who weren't afraid to play at their own at altitude against the MVP, who weren't afraid to play in the conference finals when their leader was not 100%, right? Just coming off of COVID. Now all of a sudden they're going to clam up. Like, these were all very, very, I thought, far-fetched things. Was I going overboard by saying they wouldn't win a game? Of course. There's a little bit of showmanship in all of this. But don't sit here and act like I'm crazy for saying that, like, the Suns were going to beat them and beat them pretty handily when that's all we'd seen up until that point.
Well, to defend one thing you said really strongly, I wrote about this too. We've never seen such a dramatic change in a team than we did in the middle of the playoffs, not in the middle, when Giannis and the Bucks figured out, finally, we are just going to smash teams in the paint. Smash them. And Phoenix, once that happened, they could never get their guard back up. Phoenix never recovered. Obviously, these games were competitive games. They weren't blowouts. But Milwaukee decided to play smash mouth ball with a wing built talent-wise, Shaq. And we've never seen, I made the comment, guys, Ayton had the whole offseason to narrow his game. Embiid had the whole offseason, this is a year ago, to narrow his game into being just a pure power player. Both those guys, more or less, much more power players than they had been. Remember, year one, Ayton liked to shoot threes and 18-foot jump shots. Giannis did it, like, after game three of the Nets series, which went 1 of 8 from three, and they won in overtime. I think it was 86-83. And in fact, we wrote it. Tom, you may have seen it. We charted it, his game scores. He never played another bad game again, except for the game he got hurt in, where he didn't play, you know, a complete game. It was the Atlanta series. That was his last terrible game, was the 1-for-8 game, which they actually won. He changed. So, yeah, that, I didn't predict that. I thought the Bucks could win the series the whole time because of what I saw in the Nets series. But, yeah, listen, we're all – our old editor, Royce Webb, used to always say predictions are folly. Like, he always would ask me who's going to win the series, and I always had it right put myself up at risk. But they're hard to do.
I used to call that the gunslinger's dilemma, right? If I go in a gunfight, and all I have is my six-shooter, guess what I'm shooting? My six-shooter, right? But if I go in a gunfight, but I got a six-shooter, and I got a rifle, and I got a sniper rifle, and I got a bazooka, and I got a hand grenades, I have to decide, what am I using in this situation? And so for a player like Ayton, if you just say, look, all you got is this, then he gets to be pretty good at this. But Giannis, with all of his gifts and all of the needs that the team had, is kind of a little bit of paralysis by analysis there of what to do when. And the thing that I said earlier in the playoffs was like, he's Shaq. Play him like Shaq. Around the rim, everything around the rim, everything easy. And when it comes to end of game and it's close and you need someone to make a play, give it to Chris Middleton, right? And let him be Kobe. And it's ironic because early in the playoffs, I was like, this is the team all year. I was like, Milwaukee's going to win the East. Milwaukee's going to win the East. And they get to the finals and two games in, and I was just like, I'm out on this because I'm just sick and tired of seeing the same shit over. They came out game one switched, and at halftime, their adjustment was, why don't we play drop coverage? I threw my remote control at the TV. I said, you got to be kidding me. This is what's supposed to be, like, the team has been most consistent, not only in the playoffs, by the way. All year long, the Suns were consistently good.
But, I mean, what I'm saying is how much of this is just Giannis was confident from the free throw line. If he goes 17-19 from the free throw line, that does two things. One, it gets points. And two, it gives him confidence of going to the rim. And fine, foul me. Fucking foul me. Good. I'm going to be Shaq. And the only thing you're going to do is going to try to foul me. And I mean, if he goes 3 of 15 from the free throw line, this is a totally different story. And not that we need to revisit the finals again, but
he's never been afraid. Guys, he's been fearless about it. I mean, to your point, it's one of the things I love about Giannis. He, unlike Ben Simmons, he doesn't care if he misses free throws. The current version of Giannis, going before even game six, that to me was his superpower, is fuck it, I'm going. And if I can't miss some free throws, I'm still better than you in his mind, right? And that was a big part of who they were, I thought.
That was also Shaq. Shaq's whole thing was like, he lied. He said, I make them when they count. And he didn't. But the point was, I'm not afraid to get fouled and shoot free throws.
I think there's something else too. I mean, we should be talking about going forward. That's why I bring it up now, because I know it's looking back at the finals. I've always believed that what you went through, not just in the past, but in the very recent past, helps elevate potentially your future. I think Phoenix was not served well by playing such undermanned teams in all three rounds, missing those players. And even though the Brooklyn Nets didn't have the full all their players, they still had the brand names of James Harden and definitely Kevin Durant. And so, and Milwaukee had the two previous years of abject, colossal failure. To your excellent discussion about weapons, all Phoenix had was the six shooter. And Milwaukee proved it, because as soon as they found a way to beat you, Phoenix had nothing left. They had never been forced to get to the next level of how do you find ways. That's why Milwaukee was able to adjust on the fly, abject, colossal failure, two series in a row. And then you get by Kevin Durant. These guys all know he's on another planet. LeBron, all due respect, best player in the world, best player ever, whatever. Kevin Durant is proving, as we see in these Olympics, he's on another planet, guys. He's from another planet, as is Giannis, by the way. But to get by Kevin Durant had to give so much confidence to those guys that they like, fuck it, I got no pride. We're not winning this way. Giannis finally realized I can't win shooting threes anymore, except for on occasion. I'm just going to the rim and posting offensive rebounds, whatever. That comes from who they played in the past. And Phoenix was never forced to get to that amazing level because they'd beat anyone great before.
I will subscribe to that theory. I truly believe past heartache helps you have some metal in these situations. Or not even metal, but just puts things in perspective in a way that I like to quote Rocky III a lot, the part where Apollo tells Rocky, there is no tomorrow. There is no tomorrow. When you've been to the mountaintop, almost there, and then fell at the last second, that's a feeling in the pit of your stomach that you don't forget. And I think it gives you a desperation in those moments to find ways and to find some ingenuity. I think about that Nets series, coach. You know what I think about? I don't think that gave him confidence. I think that was literally, that's the series we lose. That's the ones that we lose right there. Because at the end of the day, you know, Harden got hurt in that series and was kind of a shell of himself. Kyrie got hurt, was out. And then the next series, Trae Young got hurt, even though Giannis was hurt at the same time. So they benefited from some injury situations as well. But the reality is, the way that Nets Game 7 went, we all were like, oh, here it goes. This is how they did it again. The Bucks were playing great, and then they hit this Nets series, and then they went back to their old ways of giving Giannis the ball from 25 feet out, let him dribble his way into a wall, and is none of this works, and they're not adjusting, and here's Kevin Durant, and he's hitting all these crazy shots. It was written on the wall, done, and then it didn't. And I think that I'm with you on that. I think that gives you a different kind of perspective.
Yeah, I agree.
Coach, I want to hear from you because Amin and I have talked about on Libertar the Miami offseason where they get Kyle Lowry. They bring back Duncan Robinson. They sign PJ Tucker at a low number. Markieff Morris also coming to Miami. You know, this offseason is as much about what the Lakers have done or remodeling that supporting cast. Philly gets Andre Drummond and Danny Green back. Brooklyn gets Patty Mills and then basically restocks with their vet minimums, does pretty well in their offseason. But then you look at Miami, and I'm wondering where you put them in your pecking order of contenders. Like in the Eastern Conference, do you have them higher than Brooklyn, Philly, and Milwaukee, or do you put them in that second tier or third tier below them?
No, I have them in the same tier, maybe not ranked quite as high. Brooklyn is just, you're just betting on whether or not they're going to stay healthy, which is not a great bet. They also have Victor Oladipo again, right?
Yeah, on a minimum.
I don't like the PJ Tucker move at all. This is a team that doesn't need his culture building and his warrior toughness. They got that plenty, right? I think anyway. I think the other guys are going to help a lot. Yeah, Miami's going to be very, very good. I thought PJ was one of the worst players for the Bucks in the finals, especially. A guy takes a couple of shots a game. You don't got to guard him at all. He's really good at fouling shooters. He likes to foul shooters every game. That always drives me crazy. And I think he'll end up playing very well.
I don't think I saw this happening. The Coach Thor, PJ Tucker hate, I think is great. I love this.
Yeah, I love him. Love him, love him. Over his career, I liked him when he left the Raptors. Like, I was high on him way back then and was so amazed he went to Israel. Like, this guy's an NBA player, I thought. But I'm just saying, I thought he sucked for Milwaukee. And his best attribute for Milwaukee was he wasn't so bad as to drag everyone else down. He really knows how to play, right? College guys play the game. Pros read the game. PJ Tucker reads the game like it's the Matrix. So I'll give you that. But if you live in my family and foul a shooter, I'm making you sleep by the pool at night. Like, it is the most egregious mistake you could possibly make. And he does it three times a game. In the NBA finals, he did it every game. It drove me just nuts. But I like their other guys. And bringing Duncan back and the way they use Duncan, what an amazing story that is for the Heat franchise. No one else would do that. They would let the guy stand in the corner, maybe, if he ever got on the court. They featured him. They do feature him. And it makes everyone better because the way we actually work on Duncan Robinson shots now. No one really had done all those pin downs and runs off staggered screens and then shoot from 28 feet. No one was doing that except for the occasional elite superstar. And then Bellinelli, there's like three dudes, Kyle Korver, Bellinelli, those, you know, just a few. this guy changed things. So I love what Miami's done. I think they're going to be terrific. So Bam Adebayo has not been good offensively in this Olympics. He's a concern to play with Jimmy Butler a lot. You've got to have shooters around him. But nonetheless, I think they have a lot of moving pieces and they can beat you in a lot of ways. They don't just have a six shooter. I just question that one thing.
Coach, where can people find your work? TrueHoop.com and on your Twitter and socials. Please give them that info, please.
Yeah, at Coach Thorpe. If you like political posts, I do political stuff on Facebook. Some at David B. Thorpe. And if you want to read about a sappy old man who writes about his wife and kids, some. At Coach Thorpe at Twitter. And I think Coach David on Instagram. But I don't do anything interesting on Instagram. And yeah, TrueHoop obviously is where I'm a partner with them. And we're doing a lot of really cool stuff. And we're not going to stop. We got our podcast twice a week. I bring it in Mondays and Fridays typically, but we do it live and then we post it. Henry really attacks things that no one's writing about. And I'm just another guy writing about what's going on in the court and trying to figure out what's going to happen next.
No one covers the league like Henry Abbott and David Thorpe do. Like they absolutely, and I was happy to write for them a few months ago. Always a joy to do a pod with you and get on with you, Coach. And thanks so much. I have a lot we could get into on Russell Westbrook and stuff, but we've run out of time here and I'm in the Smokies. So thank you for carrying me. I feel like I was PJ Tucker and you guys were Giannis and Drew Holiday on this pod. So thank you for doing that.